You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Oh yeah, welcome back to another thrilling episode of the Too Old of Hell radio show. I'm Joe Thrash and Kill. With me, I've got my good and golden boy, 365 Days of Horror. Say hey.
Hey.
And we got Brenna's side. Say hey, Brenna.
Hey, Brenno.
We got a good show for you today. The second half of this, we got our good buddy Ian. I think we're going to call him our fourth mic now because he's been putting out tremendous content.
Absolutely.
He's got some more old head interview for you. He's got Brian Tatler from Diamond Head on the mic. So stick around for that because, man, he's a great interviewer. He's so good at this shit. How are we so bad at it?
No, we'll definitely send him out from now on because he seems to get the good stuff, whereas like Jordan and I are always in some really bad situation where we can't get good audio or anything. But yeah, no, Ian's been doing a great job. And yeah, if Ian ever wants to come on the show, I'm sure we can make him.
Yeah, it'll be interviewing James Lipton type situation.
Yeah.
folks, we haven't really been on for a couple of weeks, and we've missed you. We've all had a tremendous amount of shit going on, but we're here, and we're here to have a good time.
No, we're not.
We're not? I thought I was.
No, I take this fucking real seriously.
All right.
This here's my actual career, you know.
I'm going to be more professional about this shit now. Yeah. Roundtable, holidays. Did you go see your families, yes or no? Starting with you. Let's go Brenno.
Oh, with me? Well, I went to my in-laws, and for the most part, it was just me and my wife and her sister, so my sister-in-law, and then that was it. And we've kind of been over there in that exact configuration several times already, so it kind of didn't matter. So we didn't do anything big, and I had to call my parents to make sure they were alive, and you know, they were mentally okay, and they were not just like out there guilting me somewhere with some like, you know, typical boomer emotional control level of just, I don't know, like that black sucking void of just always wanting you to be miserable because you're just not following the guidelines for like family obligation.
I'm familiar with these, yes.
So I got a break from that this year. They seem to be fine. So, good. You know, I just got to enjoy turkey and stuffing and not have to hear either of my parents talk to me.
I thought that I was going to go see my family for Thanksgiving. And then, about a week before, my father was privy to what appears to be a super spreader event. So I did not go.
Oh my God.
Jordan, did you get a chance to see the fam?
I laid in bed all day and watched movies.
That's the way to do it. Did you at least have Thanksgiving treats?
I'm going to say no, but I'm not positive about that because I am genuinely trying to think of what I had for dinner and I can't remember. Yeah. But it wasn't anything traditional Thanksgiving. It was probably like a frozen dinner or something like
right.
that.
So. You can't really, if you want to take a break from a day like Thanksgiving, you can't get takeout. Nobody's open.
Yeah, you know, I've never been big into Thanksgiving. It was never a big holiday growing up. So it's just a couple of days off from work, really, and just hanging out. And so, like, I don't really feel like I missed out on anything. I think it was last year's show or the year before where we went on an extended talk about how we as millennials, who are really good at killing different industries, this was the year for us to finally kill Thanksgiving. And I don't think we did it.
No. I mean, it's so nostalgic having those like oversalted white people flavors just all on the table for you. I'm sure when people eat it, they in their head imagine it to be amazing and they have this kind of emotional craving towards it. But I mean, the food generally isn't always awesome. It's kind of like you can only get that one flavor one day a year and then you're kind of eating it for a couple days after with leftovers and. After two or three microwaves, you're like, this isn't good.
Turkey is plentiful in the United States. You can have it literally anytime you want.
Whenever you want. There's just farms. We're lousy with turkey farms. You know,
we have a fast food business that focuses just on giving you Thanksgiving meals.
Wait, which one is that?
Boston Market.
Boston Market, oh, that's right. Yeah.
You can get turkey and stuffing and corn and gravy whenever you want.
Literally August 13th, you can get that stuff.
I don't think I've seen a Boston Market in 20 years.
Hey, dude, I live in the state where Boston is our capital. I haven't seen a Boston Market in 20 years.
It was good, though. My my wife cooked veggie variations of Thanksgiving favorites, and she knocked it out of the park. It was delicious.
Did you have tofurkey?
No tofurkey. We did a stuffing variation. I say we. She is the good cook. She did a quinoa and Brussels sprouts and Gouda variation of stuffing that was fucking awesome. I know that doesn't sound like the best thing saying those ingredients together, but it's really fucking good.
I probably have to do some like major vegetarian overhaul to my own diet because I've just been eating so shitty lately. I know, whereas like you're really trying to avoid takeout because it's just like smarter and safer for you to do so, I've just kind of given up on cooking. I just fucking eat trash every day that other people prepare for me, or it's something that's just like horribly simple to prepare myself, like some fucking kids' cuisine dinner in the fucking freezer, you know what I mean? Hey man, I can't get a brownie from Stouffer's, you know.
Yeah, you get the little cup of pudding with it. That's good though. It is a shame that for the most part, you know, Thanksgiving didn't happen. I miss seeing who on Twitter has a rich family.
yeah. Always the people who talk the most shit about people who are rich. Always it happens that way.
Anyway, but I assume that everybody got up bright and early Friday for Black Friday deals, right?
Nope.
No? You didn't do it?
I didn't. What's there to buy? Like, what do I need?
Jordan, I assume that you copped a large TV and an Xbox and such.
I just went out to the stores to fight people. I just taped my knuckles up like the Hanson brothers and Slapshot and fighting people. I actually I looked just because, again, I had nothing better to do. So I looked at a few record labels and merch websites, just seeing, you know, what comes up. Why not? If something's a good deal, I could always use another shirt or hoodie or something like that. And the deals were really bad.
Yeah, that was the thing.
A lot of these like record labels, I think, like I looked at Nuclear Blast, for example, and it's like, you know, stuff is marked down to like $3.98 for a CD or something like that. But it's all bands that you go, I've never heard of this band, or I completely forgot about this band. Like a lot of them were reminders of when I used to be a radio DJ in college. It's just like, oh yeah, this band did absolutely nothing. That's why this CD is $4. Or like the alternatives where a band is selling a shirt for $30 online and they're giving you 15% off. It's like after taxes and having this ship sometimes from Europe, it's not a deal at all.
It's so still a $30 fucking shirt.
Yeah. Like I think my idea of pricing for merchandise is out of whack with what it actually is now. Because in my head, it's still like a t-shirt should be $15, maybe $20 to $25 if it's like live and the band's on tour from another country. But apparently everyone sells shirts now for $30 to $35.
It's the way of the road. You know, in my day, a hamburger used to cost a quarter.
Yeah.
I looked at Triple B Records. They were having a Black Friday sale, so like you could get a Triple B crew neck sweatshirt for normal price $50, marked down to $45. It's like, fuck this.
Yeah,
what a deal.
Right. That was my experience as you were going around online, and because you don't really want to do the doorbuster thing. I know that Jordan said he's like mosh pit starved, and I get that, but. Yeah, it's like the dumbest thing ever to like line up in front of these stores. And people still did it. I mean, there were still places where you could do that. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's smart, kind of a thing. We've been talking about that. But if you were to look around anywhere online, yeah, everything was like, oh, 8% off. I'm like, that's awesome. Great. I get to save on what I would usually pay for shipping and spend, you know, $38 on this piece of shit anyway. And I've kind of had this conversation when it comes to like Christmas in general. It's like as you get older and there's less kids in the family, it's kind of impossible to buy gifts for people or just get things for yourself, because you kind of find yourself in a situation where if it's cheap enough for somebody to afford as a Christmas present for you and you need it in your life, you already go out and buy it and you've had it. And if it's something that you really need, it's multiple thousands of dollars that nobody would ever spend on you. I don't know if any of you guys deal with that.
Christmas is for kids.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So you got to stop doing that shit. You're old.
Right. There's no gifts. There's nothing I'm holding back on that's like $40. And I'm just like, well, Christmas is coming. I should ask for it for Christmas. It's like, no, dude, I'm going to go to fucking Target today and get that shit.
Man, like I've worked with so many like fucking 40-year-old adults that are like dutifully putting up a Christmas list to send to their parents. It's like, you're fucking 40, dude.
Your hairline is gone.
Once you reach a certain age, it should be your duty to tell your parents not to send you things.
Yeah. That should be established like probably right about the time that you're like drinking. You can go ahead and cut that part out of your life out. This era has ended. I hope you had a good time with it, because it's over. it's nice to do nice things for people that you care about. But I hate the obligation for gifts. I think it's a blight on America, and we gotta stop it. We as millennials are finally killing the gift giving industry.
Yeah. Except for this podcast, when we do that episode in a couple weeks.
Well, that's different. That's entirely different.
That's entertainment. We get to write that off on right. Taxes.
I got
to
get
exactly. Also, I'm not like writing down on a fucking piece of paper and mailing to you guys like, well, this year I really want like a new pickup for my guitar and I need a new pair of socks. And it's like, no, you're going to get some random shit in a box. That's what it is.
We can talk about what pickup you want later. But yeah, I don't. One place where I do get it is from my mother. She's in like my parents. Like I feel like on the boomer side of things, like they still want presents. They still want cards. They still want that shit. And it's like, you need this shit less than I do. You know, like you have a leg up in life. You're retired. You have your account. Like you don't need shit from me.
You have money. you have resources that I do not have. Right. How about we just enjoy each other's company when there's not a pandemic?
Yeah. And just cancel Christmas. No music on the radio or anything.
I think this year we got to cancel the whole thing. Obviously the pandemic is totally out of control. It's worse than it's ever been. It's going to be worse come Christmas than it was for Thanksgiving. Let's go ahead and pull the plug. The war on Christmas is won. We did it. It's over. Please don't go fly across the country and infect other people.
Right.
Now is the time for the occupation of Christmas. The war is over, and now we just stay mired in occupying Christmas for the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
We just run Antifa drills in the Starbucks from here on out.
Exactly. It was an intentional, but it turns out siege warfare worked. The enemy is desperately sick, can't leave their confines. Now is the time to declare a decisive victory.
They can't sit in Applebee's and enjoy their $1 Christmas martinis. We've done it.
That's a Holotini now, motherfucker.
Well, I was going to say, I think during Halloween, they have Draculatinis. Where it's like a purple martini with like a plastic Dracula teeth hanging on the side of it.
Wow. It sounds like I want 8 of those.
Yeah, I might need a few.
And instead of a straw, you get a Twizzler to drink it out of.
Ooh.
But still, you shouldn't ask for Christmas presents, but you could drink that childish shit.
Yeah, exactly. You can just make your stomach sick with all the sugar that they dump in the Dracula teeny.
So let's turn the... Let's turn the conversation a bit, because we're at about our halfway point. So we're gonna have Ian talking to Brian Tatler from Diamond Head, and as everybody knows, Diamond Head is the band that should have been more successful than Metallica, because Metallica copped a lot of their style, but that really didn't happen.
Covered their tunes.
That's right.
They were big inspiration and shit.
Yeah, they were like the Anvil before Anvil was. One of those bands that's highly influential and highly talented, but they never really got the success that they deserve. But they influenced a lot of bands, like you said, Metallica, Megadeth, a lot of the American thrash metal bands owe a lot of their sound directly from Diamond Head.
Jordan, was it you who said something about how somewhere in the Wikipedia page there's like a section that just says lack of success on Diamond Head's page?
Yes, unfortunately. It's kind of like if you look at a celebrity or a musician's page and you want to see like a controversy section.
Yeah.
It's kind of like one of those things that you draw right to it. And it goes into a little bit of detail, more explaining that like they didn't really have a major record label deal, that they changed styles a lot. And like apparently they never toured the U.S. until 2002, and they've been a band since the 70s.
Wow.
So it's like, again, I'm a little more familiar with Anvil and like, you know, seeing the documentary. It sounds like it's a lot of the similar things of they're really talented, but they couldn't like find whatever that it factor is or whatever, you know, helps bands really bump up to the next level, while other bands that were influenced by them kind of passed them by. And I think they get into a little bit on the interview and kind of talking about re-recording their classic albums. And on this new album that they did, they actually cover Metallica, kind of, you know, completing the circle, so yeah. To speak.
What song are they doing?
Let's see. Well, Metallica covered what? Am I Evil?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the big one. They did a few Diamond Head tunes, but that's the one that like has stuck on their set list ever since.
They covered No Remorse.
Oh.
Oh, wow. Huh.
And it's on YouTube now. It's pretty good. They do a good job of it. It's always a risky thing to do to like cover a major band like that. But I think they do a pretty good job while still sounding like Diamond Head. Or like old Metallica sounding like Diamond Head.
Yeah, man, I had no idea they didn't make it to the U.S. until turn of the millennium. That's crazy.
It's like when I saw Anvil maybe like 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I saw them in Providence, and they said it was the first time they ever played Providence in their 30-plus year career. It's like, how do you just not play a major U.S. city just once in your entire career?
I mean, I've made it 33 years without ever making it to Providence. I understand.
You're also not in a band.
Oh, that's a fair point, I guess.
It's kind of one of those things where you don't always have to play New York or Boston when you tour. Like, you can play New Haven, Connecticut. You can play Providence, Rhode Island. You can play Montpelier, Vermont. You know, it's places that are starved to see anything sometimes, maybe some of the best shows, instead of a major metropolitan area where there's a million things to do on any given night.
And that's a great point. I think a lot of bands overlook the just like the totally show starved scene of some of these places. Like, you'll find metalheads in every single state, regardless of how sad it is. And a lot of bands will kind of pass over those areas thinking that they're going to make the biggest bucks in the biggest cities. And that's not always the case.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in a place like New York, Boston, LA, or I'm even going to throw Austin in there, like there's a million venues and they've got a stacked bill every single night. But if you go to, I don't know, Waco, like, you really don't have much competition, and the people there are kind of starved for entertainment. You can do better. You know, big fish in a small pond kind of thing. It's better than being a little ass fish and getting eaten by a big fish, right? That's the analogy.
Absolutely. Not to mention that a lot of these bigger cities, the way the people who run the venues act, I mean, it totally screws you out of any possible dime you could have made. I went with my buddy recently, and by recently, probably like last year, to like a show in New York City. We were all really excited about it, but we got there, and I mean, this guy couldn't have been a bigger asshole. Couldn't have treated us like worse trash. He didn't provide anybody with a door guy, and so everybody who wandered into that bar saw the show for totally free. And like, my buddy had to end up like paying out of pocket money. Jesus. Just to fucking be there. It was like a whole pay-to-play scheme that we just pretty much waltzed into, you know what I mean? It's like, you were supposed to have a guy collecting dollars at the front. It's like, how the fuck could we have possibly known that?
I was going to say, like, I would have figured that a promoter would be most focused on making dough, but if he's already made it from the pay-to-play, he doesn't give a shit.
Right. You know, it's like a pretty obvious game at that point. You hit up this band from out of town with this, you know, fucking slam dunk where, oh, you were supposed to have a guy collecting money at the front, and I wasn't, so now you owe me money. You know what I mean? It's like, and my guy's a, the guy I'm talking about, he's the nicest guy in the world, so he did it, but I would have told this guy to fuck all the way off.
Yeah, man. Promoters, worst people in the industry. Well, right.
And you might not deal with that in Waco, Texas, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of small to mid-sized towns out there where you can kind of go in and do your own thing and probably make away with a hell of a lot more money than you would playing at the big city. Competing against real bands.
Yeah, there's places definitely in the U.S., but I'm sure in Europe, Canada, and wherever else where people will go to the show because it's something to do, because they're so starved for entertainment. Like, I've played shows where people don't like metal. They have no interest in it, but they go because it's the thing to do on a Friday night. It's like either that or go to Walmart and hang out.
Yeah. I'm from a town like that.
A lot of us are, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how we got on this topic, but when you can play a show again, get out of your bubble, your liberal bubble. But yeah, go do that thing. When you can play a show again, I don't know when that'll be. One day, get out there. Go see the beautiful countryside of the United States of America.
It's either that or get nominated for a Grammy for a song that you put out like 4 years prior.
Oh man, that's sad times.
We got to do it. We got to cover it. The 2021 Grammy nominees.
I don't actually even know when the Grammys are, but I did see the metal performance, best metal performance list. There's Code Orange, the Grammy darlings. They show up every year looking like the Matrix.
They're getting progressively weirder.
I think that they're definitely leaning into this. I think that, you know, people were making fun of them or whatever a few years ago, and they're like, well, we're just gonna go all the way in on this now.
Right.
It doesn't help that they've been throwing out comments like how they're going to change the music industry and things like that.
Yeah, sure you are. Good for them. No beef here. There's also In This Moment, which is one of those bands that you're familiar with, but you don't actually care about.
Yeah. I mean, In This Moment, they started out as like this really awful, mediocre, like metalcore band during that time when it was like the Hot Topic era. You know what I mean?
Like 2005, 2006.
Right.
I think Beautiful Tragedy is your standard metalcore album with good female clean vocals. And I think that was kind of their little niche fitting in. And then they've kind of like almost like Code Orange progressively gotten weirder, where the vocalist Maria Bink has become like the front and center person. And like all the guys in the band like stand further back and like paint their faces and just blend into the background
wearing jumpsuits with numbers on them.
She's certainly the
she's the star.
She's the star. She's the eye candy for sure. She dresses appropriately in that regard, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, In This Moment musically, wow, these days especially, I don't even know how anyone could just sit down to an album like that and just listen to it, but teach their own, you know.
I'm pretty sure I've only heard In This Moment when we do the year-end biggest songs of the year thing. And I'm sure every year I forget what they are again.
Right. So the in-between is the performance that they're discussing, which I always get so confused with Grammy things because they're not albums. They're just songs.
Yeah.
And so I'll be like, yeah, that's not the album. It's the song. So for Code Orange, it was Underneath. For In This Moment, it was the in-between. Next on the list, you have Body Count, Bum Rush.
Uh-huh. I like that song.
Is it a good song?
I think it's a good song. I would say it's one of their best songs that they've put out in a long time. You know, if you're a fan of the band, you'll like it. But I think even if you're not, there's something in it that can get you going. It's one of those like steady driving songs. And it really focuses on like Ice-T and his politically conscious vocals and lyrics. So check it out if you like him.
Body Count is so funny. Like, Ice-T is such a funny dude because he'll have, you know, moments like that interspersed with songs where he gets mad at a teenager playing Xbox Live with him.
I think he did a cover
of Suicidal Tendencies Institutionalized, right. And in that song he talks about Xbox.
Yeah, I remember that now.
Yeah, it was like it was a cover of the song, but the lyrics were totally Ice-T's. It was a lot of fun. I think Body Count's going to win it this year, just because Ice-T has the star power. People in the industry know who Ice-T is, and I think this is definitely the time for like a black metal band. And I don't let me take that back. An African American metal band to take it home. I think it should be them.
I think it would be very interesting that happened after essentially being blacklisted by the entire industry after Cop Killer.
Cop Killer is still not on like Spotify and streaming services. You have to go to YouTube and find someone else uploading it to listen to it.
I've got my Cop Killer cassette, thanks to Jordan.
You're welcome. He's just something to blast while you're waiting in line for your bean burrito at Taco Bell.
Just got an inventory of Cop Killer on cassette. Just to send
it. Just boxes of it lining my closet.
Yeah.
There's a couple other on the list. Yep. There's Poppy, which is a gimmick that I feel is getting out of hand.
Just a little. That's from the album I Disagree, and that was a big deal for people who were dumb this year, so sorry.
People sure get mad about it.
I'm mad.
I mean, like, I don't care if this is your favorite band or your least favorite band. Like, I really don't give a shit about anybody's musical preferences. I'm just going to say, categorically, this is not for me.
Okay, just categorically, extremely not for me.
It's one of those things where, they're not hiding the fact that this is a creation. Yeah. Poppy was whatever YouTube weirdness that I can't even explain it. Just look it up yourself. And then someone just went, I have these guys who can play guitar and drums real loudly. Why don't you sing over it? And it's just, they show up, their music's used in NXT and WWE a lot. So it's just another one of those, here is a thing, we are giving it to a corporation and they're going to run with it. And that's why you know about it.
For sure. I think what irks me the most is this sort of grasp at sincerity through metal music that is going on here, which, whatever. I'm an idiot for even caring. Like, I don't care. I don't care. I'm going to give up. I shouldn't care.
That's the right way of going about this.
Yeah, it's like you got to give yourself 4 seconds of thought on that and just be like, does this upset me? Yes. Does it upset you for a good reason? No. Then I'm not upset.
Very rational. I like that.
All right. So the final edition that we were mentioning, the song that was recorded 4 years ago, Power Trip, Executioner's Tax. Now, with the unfortunate passing of Riley Gale this year, this seems to be kind of like an obvious addition. It's kind of like a postmortem sort of addition. So it's possible that they might get it for that, because that's kind of the good move in terms of the music industry, but the music industry isn't really known for their good moves, so we'll see what happens.
It seems and I could be wrong, of course, but it seems very unlikely that the Grammys, the awards set up for basically tracking sales of artists in the US, would give a pat on the back to a local boy done good. Riley was beloved by people in underground metal, people in Texas, for his contributions to underground metal and punk within that realm. And I can't really think of anything further removed than the Grammys. So, it's possible, just because metal has so little sway within a major industry like all of recorded arts, that they could just have heard it through the grapevine that's the thing to do. But it seems very unlikely to me, especially for a song that is 3 to 4 years old.
A live version of a song that's 3 to 4 years old.
I hate when they do that shit.
The only thing that I'm looking at this is that I hope they win so it increases their sales so more money can be donated in Riley's name.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. If this can help get the word out on, you know, the best band to come out of Texas in forever and one of the best dudes to come out of metal in forever, like, that's great. And hopefully they can build a few more wings onto the house for transitional youth that was being built in Riley's name.
Right on. We can only hope, but we'll see. Or we won't. We're not going to watch the Grammys. We're just gonna,
there's no way.
There's no way. There's no way. We're just going to like hear about it.
Though. Somebody will send it to me.
Right. Someone will tweet about it and we will see that tweet. Yes.
All right, boys and girls and all the good friends beyond the binary. We're going to step back. We're going to let Ian take it away here with Brian Tatler from the famous new wave of British heavy metal band Diamond Head, and they'll talk all that good stuff, and we'll take a step back and we'll talk to you guys the next couple weeks. We do have a few more interviews lined up for you, so we might be speaking with you later here, but yeah, we always have a good time coming on the show and speaking with you, and we look forward to doing it again soon.
All right, everybody, love you.
Sign up for the Patreon, patreon.com/toilet of hell.
Later.
Bye.
Hello, this is Ian for Toilet of Hell, and today we ascend the metal mountain of Olympus to talk to the god of lightning to the nations, Mr. Brian Tatler, guitarist and founding member of Diamond Head. Thank you for joining us today, Brian.
You're welcome, Ian. Nice to speak to you guys. To heaven from hell, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, obviously the reason we're talking is because we've got a 2020 re-recording of Lightning to the Nations out. Is that right?
It's out on Friday, but yes, I mean, there's three singles been released, the third today, and yes, it's coming out on Friday, and it's getting a lot of good feedback from some, you know, the journalists will have heard it by now, like yourself, and getting a lot of good feedback, so looking forward to its release.
Oh, excellent. I haven't heard the third. What's the third one today?
The third one today is No Remorse, which is the Metallica cover that we decided to do. And the video was released today at 1 o'clock. And I believe this, it's a single as well. Yeah.
Let's start by talking about that. And just as a sidebar for listeners, Diamond Head has been doing some great YouTube stuff around promotion for this album. We've got Tatler's Tales series. And so there's a lot of information covered, everything from why Diamond Head is called Diamond Head to why they chose the cover songs they chose. So we don't have to cover a lot of those basics here, thankfully, because you've answered all of that. But I do want to ask you about what it was like to learn to play and record No Remorse, because that's obviously a Diamond Head inspired song. So it's like, I mean, for you to do that song is like a snake eating its own tail.
Good way of putting it. One of the reasons I chose it was because I felt it had something of the Diamond Head style and DNA in its writing. I thought this has got touches of Diamond Head about it, so I thought if we all learn this one and try it in rehearsal, then that's what we did, and it did sound great straight away. It just really, really fitted like a glove, this band, this lineup. So there you go.
Oh, no doubt. And I guess I have a boring question, but I'm genuinely interested in it. Whenever bands do these re-recordings, I wonder how much of that is involved in intellectual property management. You know, who owns the original masters versus these, the songwriting credits and all of that. Could you speak to that a bit?
Well, we didn't have any problems. I know some bands have re-recorded albums in the past to get around that issue. If, say, an old label or an old manager owns the original recording, it's very often the case of whoever pays for the recording owns the recording. So some bands have re-recorded to get around that copyright issue, but that was not our case. We just purely decided last year that it would be good to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the release of Lightning to the Nations by re-recording the album with this lineup, modern technology, making it more powerful, more heavy. And, you know, as I've said before, the original album was recorded and mixed in a week, you know, quite quickly. So the idea of revisiting it with the experience I've got now, I mean, I've been playing for 45 years now, so I just thought we could definitely do something with it and make it a bit more, you know, now, a bit more 2020.
Yeah, and it is for sure. It's interesting to hear, to me, and I think people like me, the original recording is a masterpiece. And just the first 90 seconds of Am I Evil Alone is the most important 90 seconds in metal history. If you did nothing more than that with your life, that would have been more than enough.
Wow, that's a hell of a compliment. That has got to be one of the best compliments I have ever been paid. So thank you, Ian.
Well, you're welcome. So I guess I don't feel bad following up with this question, which is, isn't it a bit like Da Vinci deciding to repaint the Mona Lisa for us?
Well, I know what you mean. And I did think that some people wouldn't like it. Some people will just instantly not even want to listen to it. But I think that's fine. Our main concern was to do a good job, to, you know, try and improve on the original recording. You'll never, you know, that version's always going to be there. It's got a vibe about it. It's four guys in a room, 19 years old, 20 years old. And you captured the fire and the you know, almost naivety in the band. But now I just wanted to do something special for the 40th anniversary, as I say. And unfortunately, because of lockdown and the COVID thing, we didn't even get to do any 40th anniversary shows this year. And this in some way makes up for that, I feel. And I'm really, really glad we did it and that we've been able to have an album that we could put out. And, you know, I think it sounds great. And it's got the four bonus cover songs, which I was, you know, excited to do. I quite like playing covers. And so the fact that we've got a singer who's capable of singing things like Robert Plant and Rob Halford, Ian Gillan, those kind of, you know, world-class vocalists with incredible ranges, I just felt it was too good an opportunity to pass up.
Oh, certainly. But you mentioned your 19-year-old self and your 19-year-old sensibility. So I want to kind of dig into to your head from back then and think about how what's amazing about early Diamond Head is that it's putting the new in the new wave of British heavy metal. You wear your influences on your sleeve. There are moments where it absolutely sounds like it's Led Zeppelin vocals on Deep Purple guitars, but you brought something more to it. And I was trying to think what seems new. And so I've there's two things that seem new that I want to ask you about. And the first one is just the speed, the tempo. It's faster than other music. You're really pushing it. And this, other British bands have done this. People have pointed to the Beatles or Motorhead, but in those cases they say, well, it was amphetamines.
Yes.
I don't think that's a satisfying enough answer. At least that's not my guess about what's going on with Diamond Head. So where did you get an idea? Do you sit down and think we're going to really push the tempo limits here? Or was that just an accident?
Yes, it wasn't contrived. I think it purely came from the fact that we were playing these songs live, and this was our first record, so nobody knew any of our material. So when we did travel and play somewhere, we felt like we had to impress. We had to wind the audience up. We had to excite the crowd. And so we learned pretty quickly that fast songs went down better than slow songs. I distinctly remember we had a song called World that was very slow and sort of doomy. And we played it at this gig and it kind of, you know, got a lukewarm reaction, shall we say. And we just backstage said that was no good. We ain't doing that one again, and scrapped the song. So if a song didn't work well live, we would scrap it. And we soon pretty much learned that Fast songs work best live. Now, you'd had Motorhead, you'd had Judas Priest with things like Exciter, and you'd had punk rock. So you've got things like The Damned playing things like Love Song and Neat, 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 which are very fast songs. And so I think all this energy from punk rock kind of rubbed off on us, and we wanted to write songs that would be exciting and work really well live. And I think that is where we were heading, and that was what our sort of train of thought was.
Oh, that's interesting, right? I hadn't thought much that this is also all developing right alongside punk rock.
Yeah, yeah. Well, punk rock happened in 77, and we formed in 76. So I took a big dose of punk rock. I used to listen to the John Peel show and tape, you know, on my cassette recorder, tape things off the radio. And a lot of punk rock, I thought, you know, was really exciting. And, of course, I'm not a technical player, you know, in 1977. I've only been playing a year or so, 2 years maybe. So simple, powerful, fast things probably appealed to me. You know, I couldn't play like Jimmy Page or Richie Blackmore, but I could play like Steve Jones.
I wonder about this as a general British sensibility, maybe, and this is, I'm just floating an idea, but even British folk music, I'm thinking about jigs and reels, that stuff is super fast.
Mm-hmm. And that never occurred to me, but you are right. I mean, there's a technique involved in folk that I never got into. I always found acoustic music quite hard to play. I like it, of course, but I've never really gone down that route. I think it's hard enough to play a six-string electric guitar without going into acoustic or, say, a banjo, mandolin. And then, you know, there's so many different styles with thrust, rock and you know, heavy metal was kind of very new, or was about to happen. When we started, it was still called heavy rock or progressive rock. So we had a lot of fantastic influences from the 70s. Incredible time for creative time for music. It probably all just went into my melting pot and each of our melting pots, and then the four guys that made up Diamond Head coming together is what made that very unique. And just glad we made that record back in the day. We captured a moment.
So the other thing that I think is new in the new wave of British heavy metal sound that I definitely hear in early Diamond Head is that galloping rhythm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. We did that a couple of times. I don't know where it come from. Maybe, you know, things like Judas Priest or something like that, Deep Purple, you know, Sabbath. I mean, Children of the Grave has got a kind of gallop, but it's quite a slow gallop. I kind of borrowed that rhythm for Am I Evil, the fast section in Am I Evil, but of course it's much faster. So maybe I was borrowing from Black Sabbath and Priest and Purple and etc., but trying to maybe speed up as well. You know, we were probably playing out of our skin. I do remember when we recorded Streets of Gold. That's a very tricky little riff to play, and I can remember, you know, you get to the end of the song, a little bash, and I'd be like, I can't do that again. You know, that was so fast. I don't know if I could record that again. Unfortunately, we captured the tape and everybody said, yeah, that was great. Because I was literally, you know, playing out of my skin trying to get it onto tape.
This is an odd thought about the difference between the old and the new recordings that came to me, is that if I had just picked up electric guitar today and listened to the 2020 version, it's very intimidating.
Okay.
But if I listen to the original, it's like, yeah, I think I could do that, I think.
Right. That's interesting, that is. I hadn't considered that. Maybe it's just because the new version is just much more powerful sounding. It's got more layers of guitars, everything's a bit bigger and beefier. So it might be hard to kind of emulate that sound, but it probably felt doable. The original version, it was done much quicker and simpler, live in the studio, that kind of feel. So, I mean, some of the riffs are very simple. Helpless is, you can play Helpless really with almost with one finger, just moving it on and off the second fret, F sharp to E to F sharp. So I really got off on being able to come up with simple riffs rather than really complicated riffs. But there are a couple of complicated riffs. The chorus is in Helpless is tricky, and the verse in The Prince is tricky, but as I say, a simple riff. I love coming up with a really, really simple riff.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in Tatler's Tales was your story about the drummer not being able to play with a click when you first went into the studio. And you mentioned, today everything's grid aligned. And that is a difference between the sound then and now. I mean, now it sounds like it's a grid aligned album. And then it really still has, a boogie woogie feel to a lot of it. And the new recording, it's like you got the boogie out. Was that something that you were thinking about doing?
That's another interesting point that no one has touched on yet, but you're right. Obviously when we did that album, there's no digital, there's no grid, like you say, there's no Pro Tools. So the only thing we had to try and keep us in time was the click track. And we didn't even use that because Duncan was just not used to playing to a click track and certainly not used to recording to a click track.
And why would you be? Right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think nowadays you would, you'd get used to it. You'd rehearse with a click, and because it's coming, when you go into the studio, it's all going to be done to a click. So you'd practice to it, but we didn't. And I think we've been listening to albums like, the first Led Zeppelin album or Let There Be Rock or Machine Head. And they never felt like they were just rigid. They felt like they had flow to them. There was, these tales of the band would be in the studio together and, almost giving each other the nod and capturing the energy. And so I presume we did exactly the same. We thought that's how you make a record. We didn't know any other way of making a record. I think it took, maybe things like Pyromania to kind of change the rules a little bit and say, well, you can strip everything back and start with a drum machine, and build on top of it over a number of months. But that hadn't been done in 1980.
In prepping for this interview, I put up some Diamond Head playlists and just let them go on random. And I had to, at several points, get up and look at the computer again to make sure it was still playing Diamond Head songs.
Okay.
So what I'm getting at here is I want to hear from you about the way you were thinking at the time about the progression of your early albums. So like Borrowed Time seems to follow up on things from earlier work that wasn't what at least an American audience was maybe vibing on with that. And then it drifts into Canterbury eventually. Yes. And I might be in a minority, but Out of Phase from Canterbury is a fantastic song.
Thank you.
But okay. What was your thought process across those albums of getting to the point where you're like, yes, we're going to do that?
It's a strange story. It's quite involved. I'll try and get it into a nutshell in that the first album, we thought we could get a record deal with it. It was recorded in about March, April or May 1980. Then I think the idea was to get a record deal, or at least there was a school of thought where we treated that as a demo album, and we thought, right, we've got a week in the studio. Let's make the record. Let's try and get a deal with it, and then we can re-record the album properly with a producer, etc., etc. And that didn't happen. So we printed up 1,000 copies, sold the mail order, and then there was a second run of 1,000. But it took us, in fact, almost another 2 years before we got signed by MCA in January 1982. And by that time, we'd, because of the lack of success with the, A, we hadn't been able to get a record deal. And so we sort of introvertedly started looking at ourselves and thinking, oh, maybe we haven't quite found the style yet or the perfect formula. Not realizing we already had, but we kind of ignored it and thought, right, keep moving forward, keep trying to progress. We came up with Borrowed Time, Heat of the Night, and Don't You Ever Leave Me in a batch, demoed them. And we thought, this is the direction now. We'll go in this direction. So they became the main focus for the album Borrowed Time. And it was almost a slightly more Zeppelin feel now. So we'd kind of moved away from the more heavy metal style of Lightning to the Nations. So we were starting to go towards maybe a Zeppelin-y feel, you know, maybe with, you know, bigger choruses and things. And then I think as Diamond had progressed into Canterbury and then beyond that, we almost got lighter and we were trying to become more commercial. We were sort of getting a bit of pressure off MCA to have hit singles. And we were noticing lots and lots of current rock bands of the day, like Black Sabbath, AC/DC, Thin Lizzy, Whitesnake, UFO, etc., all getting on top of the pops and having hit singles in order to promote the album. So we were told the same deal by MCA, you've got to have a hit single and it'll promote the album, blah, blah, blah. So we went along with that. We wrote things like Call Me and Out of Phase, Making Music. So we've sort of been split now from being a band that actually likes writing big, long, epic songs to a band that's trying to write hit singles. And it became a very confusing time. And I feel we lost our way. We probably experimented too much. We didn't establish our, sort of following and bass, you know, style. We had a really good following in England and the UK, but we never toured the States and we hardly toured Europe. So in the end, you know, we didn't sell that many records and the kind of the castle kind of started tumbling down, if you like.
Yeah, I, for whatever it's worth, I think that the Canterbury album was really on par with Simple Minds or Big Country. It was as good as their hits. It just wasn't Diamond Head. But at the same time, around 1986-ish, you put out Behold the Beginning. So you must have had some sense that there was a desire for that aspect of Diamond Head, even as all of this was going on.
Well, by 86, of course, Diamond Head had split. We split in 85. It was by that point the manager who had put money into the band was purely trying to get money back because he felt slightly cheated that he'd invested in the band. And now he's got nothing for it because, you know, we didn't sell any records. When we were dropped by MCA, we were still in the red. So he did that deal with little labels like, Metal Blade were involved in the US, but in the UK, there's little labels like Heavy Metal Records, and there's one called Metal Masters, and he did one in Europe with different labels. And so until Reg died in 2006, he was constantly doing these little deals for 3 years and 5 years with our old back catalogue, trying to kind of claw back his initial investment. And I was not involved very often. Occasionally I would be asked for a quote or, you know, something, but I was never completely behind those releases, and some of them were a bit demo, you know, there was some 8-track demos and things sort of cobbled together, but I couldn't do anything about it.
That had to be incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
So let's talk about happier things. I'm interested in the Rasmus era, the most recent era. This seems to be the re-realization of Diamond Head that it's more in line with the imaginary of its metal fans. So could you talk about making that turn?
Yeah, so we decided we needed a singer who lived in the UK after singer in the middle, Nick, our second singer, emigrated to Brisbane in 2008. So, you know, we stayed with Nick and we'd fly him backwards and forwards, but it became more and more complicated. So we eventually decided we needed a singer who lives in the UK. And we found Raz through a friend of a friend. And initially it was just to do some gigs. We'd probably got 10, 12 gigs booked. And we needed a singer. And he auditioned and I thought he was great. We got just talking and he would talk about making an album and writing songs. And so I thought, absolutely, if he really wants to do it and he's obviously really, really good, we should make a start. So we recorded the album Diamond Head in 2015, which came out in 2016. That got fantastic reviews. And so it's just onwards and upwards into the next, you know, bigger shows. We've got a deal with Silver Lining for Coffin Train, and we're now with Siren Management and an agent in the UK. So things are going very, very well and have been building and building over the past few years. But yeah, Raz is a fabulous singer, he's a fabulous writer, but he's also a producer, and he was able to record this album and mix it and produce it. So without Raz's skills and his home studio, we probably wouldn't have been able to even make this record, Lightning to the Nations 2020. And he was able to finish it off at home, doing the vocals, mixing it, getting it ready for the end of July, while we were in lockdown and we were unable to do any gigs or get together and rehearse and write and do anything. So it's been fantastic, really, that we've managed to produce something, especially to mark the anniversary for this year.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've got to say that Coffin Train is slamming. I mean, the entire album. And I have, I guess, another snake eating its tail kind of thing for you. So when you're writing new material these days, and you have this more solid conception of a Diamond Head sound, you're also incorporating, you know, newer songwriting techniques, guitar playing techniques, and technologies. What are the new things that you're inspired by, or how has your playing changed? What's it like to be you now writing new material when, of course, the whole history between when you're a teenager and today has been influenced by you the entire time?
Yeah, good point. I think I still look back to that classic period with Lightning and Borrowed Time. I think my techniques improved over the years. I spent 10 years as a guitar teacher, and that taught me a lot of technique and improved my playing, helped me get out of a rut. And so nowadays, I think I approach the guitar a bit heavier, a bit faster. I picked up, you know, more down picking rather than alternate picking from people like James Hetfield. You know, having watched James play a song like Battery or Master of Puppets live, he's got a very impressive right hand, and I've probably copped some of that. And so when I write now, I try not to write, you know, slow songs, mid-paced. There's always something will creep through that I think's worth doing. But I will try and focus on playing faster songs that will work live, and just keep the energy of the band up. Raz is all about energy. He loves to you know, to sing in a certain way and give it a lot of power. I think we all do. We all want to write songs that will work live, that will get the crowd going and be a bold statement, really.
Out of the new material, what's the best pleaser?
What seems to be the biggest crowd pleaser, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Off the last album, The Messenger seems to go down really well. We've also been doing Belly of the Beast and Death by Design. And then off the previous album, the Diamond Head album, Bones is very popular. So we after writing Bones in 2015, that hasn't left the set yet. It's such a good song that it's always stays in the set, that one does. And there's a few off that album we do, and we can mix around. There's probably five or six at work off that album live that we can drop in and out when we feel like it. So, but you know, yeah, Raz has made a big difference. I know this is really his third album with us with Diamond Head, and his vocals are fantastic. He's an incredible singer, world class singer. So I always feel I'm lucky to have found him.
What's your other thing outside of music? What else do you do?
I couldn't possibly comment. I'm not telling you that. No, I don't know, really. Outside of music, there isn't much else. I have been obsessed with music since I was probably 12. Even if I'm just listening to music or playing music or writing music, it touches on things I do every day, practice, you know, listen, even critique. Somebody sent me a demo about 2 hours ago and said, "Will you have a listen to this? What do you think?" You know, so I'd give them my feedback, that kind of thing. So,
oh, really? It's
music. But I mean, I love films. I probably watch about 100 films a year.
Really?
Probably. And I read. I like to read. I've read a lot of autobiographies, you know, music again. And I try and keep fit. Yeah, I'm 60 now. So I've had a few health scares over the years, and I need to exercise. I need to walk, and I go bike, and I go swimming when swimming's allowed. So I try to keep fit.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? That's so hard to do. The older you get, and yeah, the longer we stay isolated. This has been excellent talking to you. Do you want to add anything else before I let you go?
Just check out the record. Have a look on the website, which is www.diamondheadofficial.com. The new video is out today, No Remorse, and the album is out next Friday, the 27th of November. So if there's anybody who hasn't heard of it yet, go and check it out.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Brian. It's been an honor.
Thank you very much, Ian. I've enjoyed that. Really enjoyed that.
listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.